Debbie. Thank you.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I apologize for the late delay. This is the time in the session where we are testifying on different bills, and so it doesn't work very well with the committee schedule. So I'm sorry that we're slow to get going. So we're going to welcome, let's see, today is Wednesday, April 12th, Senate Committee on Workforce, and get going here. And I wanted to let everybody know that we are going to be moving Senate Bills 828, Senate Bill, Senate Bill 828, Senate Bill 984, and Senate Bill 1040. Those three bills are going to be rolled over to Monday. They're currently scheduled for work sessions, but they're going to be rolled over Monday. However, with that being said, we are going to go ahead and for a moment, we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 984. We are not going to vote on it. We're going to hear from some of the people who have been working on this bill so they can give us a status update, committee members, on what's happening with Senate Bill 984, which is known as the overtime bill. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 984, and I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 984 is sponsored by the Committee on Business and Transportation. This committee held a public hearing on March 29, 2017. The bill requires employers in the industry subject to statutes requiring overtime to pay for work exceeding the maximum statutory hours in any one day to calculate overtime payments on daily and weekly basis and pay the greater amount. There are no amendments, there is no fiscal impact, and no revenue impact.
Okay, so I'm going to call up Jess here from AFL-CIO, and I believe Betsy Earls, did you want to come and speak as well, please? Or did, and then Amanda, did you want to come? That'd be great, thanks. And then Jess, is there anyone else you wanted to? Okay.
Even it out.
This is what I like to see, people working together. Very nice. Okay, so who would like to start? I'll leave it up to the three of you.
Yeah. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, thank you for giving us a couple of minutes. We did want you to know that we've been meeting regularly with AOI and OBA and AFL-CIO to negotiate some additional provisions to the bill. You heard a lot about worker safety and concerns at the public hearing a couple weeks ago, and so we're hoping to come back to you and deliver on some of those. We do have a note down to Legislative Council via your committee, so we hope to have actual language to you on Monday, and I'll let Jess speak to some of the specifics. I will say we're close. We're not there. There's still a pretty key provision to negotiate, but we're hopeful by Monday we'll get there.
Hi, everyone. Jess Genatino with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I just want to thank both Betsy and Amanda for willing to have conversations around these important protections. I think at the end of the day, what we really want to see is workers in this industry that we know is really difficult have some protections around both the hours that they work in a day but and also a week, and a right to rest between shifts, because like we know, the workers that we heard from were working really long weeks, not being able to go home for a substantive amount of time. So that's what we're hopeful we can come back with on Monday.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I think that everything that I would have had to say has been said. We are working very, very hard to come up with something that we can all agree with, and we're hoping to be back to you by Monday.
Okay, great. Does anybody have any questions for the committee members? I mean, for our panel here, rather. Sorry. Okay, all right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay, so we look forward to hopefully we will have the paperwork ready to go with an amendment, and we can vote on Senate Bill 984 on Monday. So I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 984 to, let's see, the Monday will be the 17th, correct? To Monday the 17th, 2017. Now we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 560. Ask Deborah to summarize the bill.
Senate Bill 560 is sponsored by Senators Knope, Bartschiker, Boquist, Ferrioli, Hansel, Olson, Thatcher, Winters, and Representative Nierman. The committee held public hearings on February 13th and on March 15th, 2017, including hearings on the -2 through the -9 amendments. Today, the committee will hear the -10 amendments for the first time. The original bill redirects employee contributions from their IAP account to a newly created account that will be used to fund member pensions. The -10 amendments replace the measure. It changes the calculation of benefits for members of the public employees retirement system under the full formula method for service after January 1st, 2018 by changing the pension multipliers for both general service members and for police and fire members to a percentage that is to be determined. It also changes the calculation of the final average salary by calculating the member's average annual salary over 5 years instead of 3 years and excludes any lump sum payment for accumulated unused vacation leave or other unused paid leave accrued on or after January 1st, 2018. It requires the PERS board to create a member pension contribution account for each PERS member and every 2 years to set the percentage of salary that a member is required to contribute to the account. It requires different ranges of employee contribution rates for different member classifications with amounts to be determined in statute. It prohibits employers from making required contributions to member pension contribution accounts. It allows employees to redirect contributions to the employee's individual account program account to the employee's member pension contribution account as an alternative to contributing additional percentage of salary. It requires a recalculation of employer contribution rates to reflect the savings attributable to the act and makes corrected rates effective July 1st, 2017. It provides for expedited Supreme Court review of petitions by adversely affected persons and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, so this is, although you listed the several of the sponsors of the bill, I think we really think of this, or the amendment rather, I think we really think of this is something that Senator Knope has been working on. So I've asked Senator Knope to provide us with a few comments before we hear some testimony.
Yeah, so I think it's important for everyone to keep in mind that the PERS bills are going to be going down to Ways and Means on Monday, and that the reason for this Dash 10 amendment and where it came from, and part of the reason we want to talk about it today, was because we're trying to be as transparent as we can possibly be about all the options that are out there. And so this came from the Oregon Business Council. They have testified before, but their interest or their ideas, or at least some of them, had not been put into a draft form yet. And so thus the Dash 10 amendment. So I think that it is safe to say that if something's going to happen as it relates to PERS, that none of the amendments are likely to just move as they are. So I think you could assume that if elements of this were to become part of a package, that they would change. And so I know in legislation, you know, words mean things, but because it's likely to change, I'm not going to get into a lot of the technical issues about the bill, because it was everything these days is kind of a rush draft. And so I think there was an attempt to try to encompass what the Oregon Business Council was hoping to bring forward. And some of the concepts that they put in this Dash 10 have already been vetted in other amendments and have gone through the committee process the way we intended it to. But I just really want to focus on one element that has not been really brought up, I think, in a significant way, and what the amendment tried to bring forth, although I think, again, I think we would need different language. But it's essentially a idea, for lack of a better word, of risk sharing. So the idea was to keep kind of all benefits intact and reinstate employee cost sharing above a specified level of the employer's support so that those earning richer benefits would pay more. And so, again, the idea is to set a maximum on what employers pay in full for PERS benefits above which costs are shared with employees. And employers would pay, they had the first 8% of salary for miscellaneous employees and up to 10% of salary for police and fire. And then any amount above 8 and 10% would be paid in equal portions by employers and employees. So this was kind of the idea that they brought forth. And so the rates would be computed separately for employees and in the kind of the pre-2003 plans, which would be Tier 1 and Tier 2, so those who earn richer and higher cost benefits would pay more. And then all employees would have the option of redirecting some or all of their future contributions to supplemental retirement savings plan to cover their contributions to the pension plan. And so I thought it was really important that we at least talk about the concept, bring it forward so people know that that concept is being talked about, and that you know, that they, it was an interest of the Oregon Business Council to bring that forward. And so I don't want to particularly go into all the details of the Dash 10 because it's going to change. And so we did want to make sure, though, that everybody who has an interest in the issue was aware that, you know, it was out there. And because it was talked about in committee, we wanted to make sure it was drafted and then people could actually see what was involved with that. And so with that, Madam Chair, I don't have a lot more to say unless committee members or somebody has questions about that or the process.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah. I better wait for the panel to talk.
Okay. So let's go ahead and bring up Edith Rush, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Taylor and members of the Senate Workforce Committee. For the record, I am Edith Rush, and I am a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. I am also a retired educator who is not a member of PERS. So essentially, after listening to weeks of testimony that you have provided from this committee, which has been very informative, and investing many hours in our own research, Tax Fairness Oregon has concluded that in order to sustain a quality pension system, which PERS is, requires some challenging changes. By way of my own credentials with this, as I said, I'm not a PERS member. I was an educator in Oregon for 7 years and then left for another position in another state, and at that time transferred my pension system into buying a house in Washington. Looking at the current PERS system, if I hadn't done that, I would have a much wealthier retirement. I also spent time in Ohio, so I'm retired from the Ohio public employees system. And they have engaged in 15 years of working on these modifications right now to save their system and to get it back to the point where it has stability to it. So you're not the first group to have to struggle with this. I'm also a Wisconsin native. They have probably the number one pension system in the country that has been anywhere between 98 and 100% funded for its entire lifetime. And it's because they have some flexibility in that system that has allowed them to do it. And lastly, I spent 7 years in New Jersey. I was there at the time when the state decided not to even pay into the pension system and did not do that for years. And I will tell you that currently they have a billion dollar unfunded liability. So we're kind of chump change in comparison to that. Many TFO volunteers have been or are public employees, so we really understand the issues of the individuals who are members of that system. You know, the angst you hear from the firefighters who sacrifice their days off to come here and listen to things that are going on, and the detailed charts you get about what somebody will lose. Those are real decisions, and they affect people's lives. But after listening carefully to all of the testimony, consulting with some of the administrators of the system, and we looking at all sides, we developed the following criteria for our own suggestions from Tax Fairness Oregon. We believe that in order to retain a quality public workforce, the adjustment should be modest. In comparison to national systems, our PERS program is not a disaster. I think that's really important to understand.
Pardon me, Edith, I just want to understand. Are you testifying on the bill on 560?
On Dash 10.
You are on the, yes. Dash 10. Okay, mm-hmm. I just want to make sure we're
speaking
about...
But I've read all the other dashes, too.
Of course. So today we're talking about... just want to be mindful of that we're talking about the Dash 10 Amendment.
I'm talking about the
we
Dash 10.
We want to hear your thoughts on the Dash 10 Amendment.
Okay. But we use the criteria as we looked at the original 560 and all the other dashes as well.
Okay.
We also agree that any changes have to meet the criteria of moral, which is difficult. We also believe that we want to maintain a pension system that supports, values, and respects public servants. The other thing that we noticed is we wanted to increase equity among the three plans, prospectively bringing the benefits of Tier 1 and 2 more in line with OPSERP members, we believe is an important factor to consider. So after reviewing all of these DASH amendments, we think that the DASH 10 amendment actually offers a reasonable and fair solution for stabilizing the PERS system over time. We do not claim to have expertise of our PERS administrators, but we offer these observations based on extensive study of healthy public pension systems nationwide. Just a couple of points. The multiplication factor, which is one of the first things identified. Only three states in the nation have a multiplier as low as those listed in the DASH 2 amendment. The most common multipliers match what we have in our current OPSERP system. We believe OPSERP, as it's defined, is a fairly solid plan. It's sustainable, it's affordable, it offers reasonable retirement benefits supplemented by Social Security. It may need some adjustments, but overall we feel it's kind of a model of what would be have been nice to have in Tier 1 and Tier 2 for it to survive. The amendment in the DASH 10 does not specify a percentage of final average salary, and we'd encourage legislators to retain the current OPSERP numbers rather than going as low as those identified in the DASH 3 amendment. We believe that a dramatic reduction in the multiplier is one of those factors that could trigger massive early retirements, thus depleting our public workforce, and that also would increase the unfunded liability dramatically. The calculation of final average salary is something that we also had proposed and something that we submitted to the committee. Removing vacation pay and sick leave from final average salary will increase equity among the three systems. And using 5 years to calculate final average salary is also a very common adjustment going on in systems across the country. People are living longer, and that is probably one change that is being made the most. The assumed interest rate issue is one that we were very concerned as we looked at the DASH 3 amendment. We were concerned simply because we believe that the PERS board needs to maintain the authority and flexibility in order to make decisions on actuarial items. And they spend a lot of money with actuarial consultants that do a good job. So we were happy to see in the DASH 10 amendment, in Section 10, that it really was set up for the PERS board itself to make the adjustments on that. The employee's 6% contribution to PERS, we struggled mightily with this because there's so much interaction between PERS, the IAP, the pickup. It's one of those things that gets so convoluted. And we believe if we've interpreted Sections 12, 16, and 17 correctly, we think the authors of this amendment have crafted a workable adjustment to the most confounding issue confronting the longevity of PERS. Now, if our interpretation is accurate, and I can't guarantee it is, I do not claim to be an expert in this at all, ending the employer pickup or even modifying it, this change would stabilize local budgets and diminish the constant lurch between hiring and layoffs that we have with the current system. Right now, those adjustments only fall on contributions from employers, and they affect all of our lives in a variety of ways. Another thing is adjusting the employee contributions to the PERS account based on the funded ratio of the system. This actually, I spent a lot of time reading that last night, just trying to make certain I have it straight. We believe this change matches the flexibility of some of the most stable pension systems in the country, and yet it still maintains the individual accounts. So I see this, if I'm accurate on this, that it would be adjusted in a similar fashion that we now just do for that employer contribution. And it would create some shared risk-taking, but it still offers the opportunity that it would not always be fully going into that PERS account there. If the system is functioning fine, we're funded at 95%, you would have some of your contribution that could go into IEP. That is what we are interpreting this. Finally, making provisions for differential member contributions for Tier 1 and 2 and OPSERP members, we strongly support this change. We feel to some degree it has something to do with employee morality in a system where the person working alongside of you is actually a part of a much more lucrative pension system than you are. The DASH 10 amendment will no doubt affect the bottom line of IAP accounts. and it may lead to early retirements for some. But we suggest these decisions are not just about retirement funds. Bringing additional stability to the PERS system is actually about the working conditions in our public entities and the welfare of our communities. Keeping the status quo is going to affect class sizes. It will cause layoffs. It will reduce city services and keep our valued public agencies from fulfilling their actual core missions. Tax Fairness Oregon concludes that without some changes to the structure of PERS, plus changes to the structure of Oregon's revenue streams, the issues of PERS and a budget shortfall will reappear after every economic downturn. So we thank you for the opportunity for this, and we wish you success. This has not been an easy item to tackle, and we appreciate your courage.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. So now we're going to bring up Dennis Erickson and Pamela Fields, please. Welcome.
Hi. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Dennis Erickson, Cornelius, Oregon. I'm here to testify in opposition to 560, particularly the emergency clause, which is attached to Amendment Number 3 and Amendment Number 10. I've worked for the past 38 years with Washington County Community Corrections, the majority of those years in a senior management position. I notified my employer several months ago of my intent to retire November 30th of this year. I did this in order to allow for a smooth transition and a selection of my replacement. This is intended to allow that my employer the adequate time to recruit, to train, and to get that person on board. I now face a dilemma. Do I honor that November 30th retirement commitment that I made in good faith to my employer, or do I retire on April 30th or May 31st in order to avoid the impact on my retirement benefit caused by that emergency clause? Now, this is a far bigger issue than just me. I am one of many senior folks who have been involved in the public service system for some time. But many Oregon agencies, if not most, face that same real prospect of the loss of vast institutional knowledge without the adequate time to fill those positions because the senior staff are forced to either gamble with their retirement benefit or retire in a matter of weeks, potentially. It doesn't have to be this way. I ask your committee to strike the emergency clause from those two amendments, and this in turn would allow for more orderly transition of senior staff contemplating their retirement. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for coming to testify. Hello.
Hello. So thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm a PERS Tier 1 Money Match employee, currently working for higher education. Our agency is relatively small, consisting of about 130 employees, of which about 10% are now planning to retire based on the impacts outlined in Senate Bill 560, particularly the amendments in 3 and 10. I began my career in state government in 1983, shortly after graduating from high school, during a period in time in which working for the state of Oregon was still considered prestigious. For the first 20 years, I watched as several friends and family members turned up their noses to the jobs that I would oftentimes refer their way. Instead, they made a choice to work in the private sector where they were oftentimes making 25 to 35% more in pay than what I was making after having worked for several years. I also watched as other friends and work acquaintances made the decision to leave state government early in their careers after having received work experience and on-the-job training. Those were all choices that they made long ago. I, on the other hand, chose to remain loyal to the state, to continue to work and to continue to train and to continue ever so slowly to promote. Just over a year ago, after going back to school while working full-time, I finally finished the classes that I needed to secure what I thought would be a promotion that I wanted and needed to carry me through retirement. Instead of feeling secure in my newly obtained promotion, I, like so many others, am lying awake at night pondering over what will happen to me as I'm forced into making a decision at the age of 54 that I'm not ready to make. I cannot turn back the hands of time to 1983. I cannot take back the choices that I made, choices based entirely upon the promises made to me by the state of Oregon. I ask that all of you, as members of this committee on workforce, look at me as the person that I am, not the number tied to my PERS account, and know that I personally am not ready to die off. Please consider the many lives that will be impacted by the final financial devastation that this bill and the attached amendments will create in our lives. My home, like many others, depends on the necessity of a dual income, and my family relies on my health insurance. I ask that you all please reconsider before making this decision to pass a bill of this nature. I kept my promise, and I now ask that the state of Oregon keeps theirs.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fields. I appreciate you coming to testify. I know it's hard to come and share the story, so I appreciate you taking the time to come and talk with us.
Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions? Okay, thank you both. Appreciate it. And so now we're going to have Scott Winkles and Melissa Unger come up, please.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, thank you. I think I've testified before on Senate Bill 560, and I'm sure I will testify again as the amendments move on. But I do want to echo the concerns of the two people who just testified. That is what we're hearing every day right now from our members. Melissa Unger, SEIU Local 503 political director, if I did not say that. But that's what we're hearing every day from our members right now. And one of the issues that were brought up, I do think, is important for the next round of this conversation, is changing these bills from having an emergency clause to having a date certain on January 1st, 2018. For people who are reading these bills, who are engaging in these hearings, it causes unnecessary stress, since I don't believe it's the intent of this legislature to PERS couldn't do it to make those changes with an emergency clause. So I would encourage, as this goes forward, to change that to a January 1st, 2018. We continue to have clear concerns and opposition to these proposals, but I do think that that is something that would give a lot of people a little bit of breathing room as they try to make decisions about what their next steps are in their career and in their retirement. So I hope that that change will happen as we continue in this long conversation about PERS.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, which is comprised of all 241 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon. I would like to address my comments to the Dash 10. It is my reading of the Dash 10 amendment that the emergency clause is operative for the purposes of allowing PERS to recalculate rates, and that the operative sections of the bill that address pensions are effective as of January 1, 2018. That 2018 date is also important to the League of Oregon Cities. We have a number of people in both in bargaining units and on the supervisory side that are looking at this and are making some decisions. We believe that regardless of whether or not it's a union employee or a management employee, everybody should make these decisions based on facts and have the benefit of time. There are elements in the Dash 10s that we believe should deserve further consideration. I'm intrigued on the cost share provision in the bill in particular. We are conducting our own financial analysis and legal analysis on that, and we will be reaching out to the OBC to converse with them. But we do believe that folding the Dash 10s into 560, I think, gives people, even if they're nervous about the concepts, they will know that it will be January 1 of 2018, and no one needs to have a rush into this decision. I mean, we are hearing stories from folks right now that financial advisors are telling them that to protect themselves, they must leave. And that's extremely unfortunate going forward. So we would, again, humbly suggest that the 10s be folded into that bill, into 560.
Okay. Vice Chair Knope.
Yeah, so just a comment. So it's my intent that there be a date certain on anything that happens. And although I am in the minority and cannot necessarily affect that, I can tell you that I will advocate for a date like a January 1, 2018. usually, just so people know, in today's current atmosphere in legislative council, a lot of things get emergency clauses put on them that we don't necessarily request. And I've never requested an emergency clause for any of these bills, but sometimes they come back that way. And it's easier to deal with that through amendment than it is to have them rewrite the bill and send us another copy, because it's been quite the chore down in legislative council this session. So I just wanted to be clear with people that I don't intend for there to be an emergency clause that forces people to retire before they can make that decision, you know, through a date certain, and kind of calculate when they need to do that.
So I just, 1 second, Senator Gelser. So we've heard from not only from the two of you, but from some others about the emergency clause situation. And instead of going into a lot of detail, basically I agree with what Senator Canope said. These are not my bills or my amendments, but I too have experienced that emergency clauses sometimes get put into bills, and sometimes they have ramifications that are rather serious. And this is obviously an example where it could be rather serious, especially since Dash 10 replaces the bill. And so I too will, if we were to move forward with any of these, we would make certain that any dates of any type for anything, that would be a well thought out decision. So just want to make certain that, and we can talk about anything moving forward, whether or not we should amend it in this committee. And it is correct that Senate bills 559 and 560 on Monday, unless something changes, which can happen, our intention is for those two bills to move to Ways and Means. And so we can have a conversation about whether or not to amend, make some amendments on regarding emergency clauses if needed. So, then Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have heard so much about the emergency clause, and I know that however we're sending these bills down to Ways and Means, that there will be further work, that it's the next juncture of the conversation. But I think if we could proactively take the emergency clause off, it not only would alleviate significant anxiety in our communities, but also may prevent us from losing some really good people from the workforce, because I'm starting to hear from people that are turning in their retirement papers, and I don't think we intend to have that consequence just because of a style issue of the way that we draft.
Yeah, absolutely.
Senator Taylor, if I may, Chair Taylor, if I read the tens correctly, the intent is that PERS recalculate employer rates going into the 19. Going into the next rate setting cycle. If that is correct, you probably do need an emergency clause at the end, but the way the tens are drafted, any change in benefit calculation, any change in multiplier, any change in the spiking issue, based on my reading, that all takes place in the draft as January 1 of 18. So if we need the rates recalculated, then I think the emergency, the E-clause is probably necessary, but the operative dates in the substantive portion of the bills, that doesn't seem to be an issue. Nobody's change and multiplier change doesn't take place until the first of the year, based on my reading and the author.
So I want to, and I know a lot of people are watching, I want to make something abundantly clear. So we have Senate Bill 559, we have Senate Bill 560, and there was Senate Bill 912, and obviously you see the series of amendments that are before us. On all conversations, I can tell you, speak for myself, that I always make certain that I'm extremely mindful. There are all sorts of dates in all of these bills. And there's what you just brought up, Mr. Winkle, which is a very important issue. But there are all sorts of dates in all of them that we have to take into consideration. And as I've said in previous hearings, there is an interplay if more than one of the amendments, any of the amendments were passed, the impact of one amendment on the other makes a significant difference. And so I want to rest everyone to be assured that our, as Senator Gelser and I think Senator Canope, I'm going to go ahead and be as bold as everyone on the committee, we do not want anyone going and, you know, prematurely seeking retirement based on hearings and these conversations. This is us as the legislature in this committee having the conversations about potential PERS reform in the public light and being transparent about it. And at this point, there are still conversations. Obviously, we have not voted on any bills, moving them to the floor for a vote of the Oregon Senate at this point. So they're moving to Ways and Means, and I am will commit, and it sounds like we heard from Senator Knope also, that we're very mindful of the there's all sorts of language used. There's the effective date, operative date. There's if you need an emergency clause in order for the PERS agency to be able to do certain work. There's a lot of language that's used in our legislation, in our bills. And again, I want everyone to be aware of the fact that I'm mindful of the fact that these dates matter and that we will take all these factors into consideration to, you know, to make certain that no one goes and does anything prematurely. So. Sounds like you want to say something?
Chair Taylor, thank you. I do want to say something really quick. I do think for us, I mean, I think as we're talking about the emergency clause, so many of these conversations are interpreted by thousands of public employees that we that are listening every day. And I think it is important for us to note that I do think because the dash 10s have not gotten much more than this kind of initial hearing, and we, you know, I don't think we prepared to speak on them, I think we would be hesitant to see them adopted as the version of the bill moving forward. And so I think our preference would be if there is an emergency clause change, that it was just done to the base bill and that that was the one change, and then the base bill was moved with that one change out of the committee. I just want to make sure that that is our position, that we don't, I don't think there's been a good debate on the dash 10s. I do believe people perceive things. So if those were adopted, I think that would be the new perceived proposal moving forward. And so I just want to make that point in terms of just the comments on the emergency clause. I think that I just wanted to be clear that we would rather just have that change just because I think that I just want to make it clear.
Okay, Ms. Ungert, so thank you. I will again reassure everybody that we are moving Senate bills 559 and 560 on Monday, April 17th, to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. We are not amending, we are not taking the dash, we have the list of all there because it's not a consecutive set of amendments because they go out of order because we never make anything simple around here. And so there are the dashes that are on OLIS are the dash 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 10. We are not going to put any of these, the intention, and again, things can change, but right now, my intention is we are not going to put any of the amendments into Senate Bill 560. There is, we have received the feedback that folks would like to see the emergency clause for now removed from Senate Bill 559 and 560. And we will have some additional conversations, and I can see that that could, you know, very well happen. And but the any amendment that would occur to 559 or 560 would be to amend it to remove the emergency clause. We are not moving any of these, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, or 10, into Senate Bill 560. I hope I've made that clear for everybody so there's no confusion going forward. Have I said that clearly enough, Senator?
I think you have. So we are requesting a committee draft amendment to remove the emergency clause from Senate Bill 560. Is that correct?
Yes, and is there one on 559, I imagine?
Haven't looked yet.
And I'm sorry, Senator Montes Anderson, while we're double-checking things, you've been waiting patiently.
I really have a problem in having policy done in Ways and Means, and it sounds like policy is going to be done in Ways and Means when we don't really know the impact on the number of retirees that are going to retire. I know this is a big issue, but I think it's really risky. And whether it's ethical or not, I don't know. So how do any of these amendments affect employer payout? That would be a nice thing to know. How does, if anything, does it affect the unfunded liability? I mean, none of these questions are being asked, and that's very frustrating for me.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator Montes Anderson. To remind the committee members that when we had the bills vetted the amendments, rather, I should say. There is quite a bit of information on OLIS, some of those questions. One of the things, and I don't want to speak for the PERS agency, and maybe it would be appropriate, I'm not sure, to have them come up, but one of the things I've learned in this process is that it's very hard to predict how individual employees will react. And so we've also heard feedback that the public wants us to be having these conversations in the committee and to be transparent about, which is what I think we've done here. And so we are talking about the impact of these bills. However, I have not been convinced that anybody truly knows how an individual employee would make a decision. But what we can do is, as I've said a few times here today, and we'll again say again that the intention is not for folks to act prematurely and to go and seek retirement, and et cetera, without full information. So regarding moving the bills to Ways and Means, I understand your concern. We are hitting the chamber deadline. And as you know, in our last meeting is on Monday. And so these bills to go ahead and adopt any of these amendments that have been discussed to date, there is not consensus on which amendments folks would like to see move forward, if any. And so the options that are before us are to not move the bills or to continue the conversation. And regarding the Dash 10 amendment, I will personally be advocating that that amendment, and I've discussed this with Senator Knope, that I would like to see the Dash 10 amendment go through the same rigor that we put the other amendments through. We've had the criteria, which is all on OLIS, and there is thorough analysis done of each of the amendments we've mentioned here today, except for the Dash 10, because as Senator Knope mentioned, this came a little bit later. Yes, I made an exception to the deadline. The Oregon Business Council's worked very hard on this amendment, and Senator Knope is the vice chair, and he, you know, requested that this be considered. And so the amendments, as for those who do not know how the process works, live with the bills. So the bills will go to Ways and Means for the conversation to continue. With all that being said, I understand Senator Mona Sanderson, and there are many arguments of why one does not want to see policy made in Ways and Means. So it's a matter of making choices that are before us now. And so that's where we're at. So did you want to respond?
Well, I've let you know my concerns.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Is there something you would like to advocate for?
No, I can't support something we're sending down to Ways and Means. I just can't. Okay. I don't think it's ethical. I think it's risky. I think it's poorly thought out. I am very concerned about the impact on our employees when a contract has been made, and we made so many changes in 2003. I would like to see those being what the result is of all of the changes that were made in 2003, and can we deduce from what happened there to what possibly would happen with any of these amendments. So I just need to get that on the record.
Completely understandable. Completely understandable. So, does anybody else have anything to add?
And Senate Bill 559 also has a emergency clause. So, I would be happy to have that taken
So we will make a formal request here on the record. Senator Knope and I would both like to see for Senate Bill 559 and 560 to have the emergency clause removed. And Deborah, our administrator will see that we have an amendment drafted so we can amend both those bills on Monday before they go to Ways and Means. Does anybody else want to say anything else about Senate Bill 560 before we close the hearing on that?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So, again, my understanding is that the proposal at this point is that on Monday we would be moving these bills possibly without a recommendation, and that that we wouldn't necessarily be making a commitment to where any of us would be on whatever the final product of the bill is later on, since that's undetermined.
I think that is correct. Great. So yeah, it is my intention that we move Senate Bill 559 and 560 now, based on feedback about the emergency clause, that we would, something could change, but my intention is to amend them to remove the emergency clause for both of those bills, and then they would be moved to Joint Ways and Means without a recommendation. And the reason for not having the recommendation, Senator Manos Anderson, is because due to the fact that, you know, we've had the conversations about the amendments, and there is not consensus about which ones to support and not support. And so sending them to Ways and Means so the conversation can continue down there, and they will have all the information. The vetting has been extensive by LFO, LC, the PERS agency, Milliman, the actuarial firm, quite a bit of public testimony, as we all know, hearings, et cetera. There's quite a bit of information there that the Ways and Means Committee would have. But again, with all that being said, I want you to know that I completely hear you that about not wanting to have policy made in Ways and Means, and it's generally not what we do.
Could I follow up?
Yes, Senator
Gasser. So I really appreciated that part, and I just think there are I completely understand where Senator Manos Anderson is coming from, and as a policy, I think those of us that are policy chairs always get a little nervous when things happen to bills down in Ways and Means. I also, as I've wrestled with this and knowing this might be where we land, especially because I have complicated relationship with the subject matter and where I am on different proposals within it. I think it's important that both sides of the building, both the House and the Senate, are engaged in this conversation moving forward, and we don't have a joint rules committee for that conversation to take place. So I appreciate both your clarification that whatever we do on Monday is not it kind of like when we put bills into the process at the beginning, and you know, voting for a committee bill does not suggest that we support or oppose a bill. It's a courtesy to move it along. That's the way that I would look at that on Monday, rather than having that interpreted as I'm supporting either of those base bills. I think at this point almost everybody here agrees that the base bills need amendment, just whatever amendment it is needs further discussion. And then I just, sorry for so many words, but I also just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair. I think this has been a really good process, and if I think about conversations that I've been involved with regarding PERS in the past decade or so that I've been in the legislature, my experience has been that we pretty quickly retreat to, I'm on this side and you're on that side. I have learned so much in this process, and in places where I have moved in my thinking, I've been grateful for that. I have been grateful to feel and find that there are parts of my thinking that are backed up by pretty robust fact. And what I come away with from this entire discussion is how complicated it is, how important it is that we are always forward-looking in terms of the public policy we set and how it impacts not just the people that are right in front of us today, but a generation from now, and that there aren't easy solutions, and that the problem is real, and that you can have a problem that is real and difficult for local governments and state governments, and that doesn't make the solution easy, constitutional, or fair. And you have done a good job of allowing us to have that conversation, and Senator Knope, I just can't say enough how much I've appreciated this process and how much I've learned.
Thank you, Senator Kelsey, I appreciate that. Okay, and so before we close the public hearing, Ms. Fields, I'm so sorry, is she still here? Okay, I'm sorry, I just need you to come up and state your name for the record. Apologize for that. We are not short on process here, so I apologize.
It's Pamela Fields.
Okay. Does that suffice, Debbie? Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so now we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 560, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 999, and I'm going to ask Deborah to read the bill. Summarize the bill. Sorry.
Senate Bill 999 was introduced by the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. This is the first time the committee is hearing this bill. It prohibits a person from filing simultaneous or consecutive claims against an employer during employment and on termination of employment for substantially similar alleged violations of certain wage and hour violations if the employer failed to remedy the alleged wage and hour violation prior to the employee separation from employment. It also limits the employer's liability to pay penalty wages for certain wage and hour violations. There are no amendments at this time.
Okay, so we'll call up Betsy Earls and John Dudry, please.
Other coming, Madam Chair, what I've learned from our visits is that this is not that other bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association. And with me today is John Dudry from Stoll Reeves. We have had a number of members over the last several years have problems and issues around the issue of final paychecks and how those are calculated and what may be left out of them by mistake or perhaps intentionally, but frequently by mistake. We wanted to bring this piece of legislation before you today to start a discussion about some of the problems we're having with final paychecks and hopefully come back to you in 2016 with something that we can work with in the legislature. So John's going to explain some of the details. I believe we've visited with all of you, but for now, go ahead.
So thank you, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. this is a really dense area of the law and an equally dense bill, even for someone who does it all day. So one of my goals here with my hopefully brief testimony is to sort of step back from the legislative language and then just talk in real terms what the law looks like and the problem.
Pardon me, before you go, can you just state your name for the record, please?
Of course, yeah. I don't want to get called back.
it's not that bad to get called back, but it's just easier for Debbie here.
John Dudry, J-O-H-N, last name Dudry, D-U-D-R-E-Y.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. So that's my goal today. So let's start with the final paycheck statute, which is ORS 652-140. And what that law says in so many words is that employers have to pay employees all their wages when they leave employment on a certain timeline. Sometimes it's the last day, sometimes it's the next day. It depends on a couple of different circumstances that come up. The penalty to the employer that doesn't do that is one day's wages for every day that the paycheck is late. So if it's one day late, the employee gets his or her regular rate of pay times 8 hours for that day, and so on and so forth. One day, 2 day, 3 day, 4 day, for every day that it's late until it's paid, up to a maximum of 30 days. And that's been the law in Oregon for time immemorial. So it sounds like a timing statute when I describe it that way. But the way it actually plays out is that it's more of an amount statute. The claim that we get, that we defend, or we get the demand letter, isn't so much that the employee didn't receive the final paycheck on day one or day two or whatever it was. The allegation instead is that they got a final paycheck, and they got it on the timeline that ORS 652-140 says they should have, but it didn't include some amount of wages that they say they were entitled to from their employment. So say that there was a deduction made during employment that the employee says was unlawful, and that happened months, years, whatever, earlier, but it wasn't corrected in the final paycheck. So the allegation we hear is, well, yeah, you gave me my final check on time, but it didn't have that, let's say, $10 that you deducted that you shouldn't have. Therefore, you owe me 30 days of wages, because you didn't give me my full and final wages upon termination of employment. So just to clarify, to provide an example, the minimum wage in Oregon, it depends on the regions, but it's at least $9.75 an hour every place. $9.75 an hour times 8 hours times 30 days is $2,340. The $10 deduction that happened during employment could lead to $2,340 of employment of penalties simply because it wasn't paid at the time the employee left work. I don't think that's fair. I'm all for penalizing bad actor employers that don't pay wages, but $10 or $1 or 1 cent, frankly, because it doesn't matter how much or how little the unpaid wages are, leading to that kind of penalty wage just doesn't seem right to me. So what this bill does is say, okay, look, we have lots of statutes on the books about paying employees wages during their employment. They've got an overtime statute, we've got a minimum wage statute, we've got a regular wages statute, we've got a deduction statute. If you have a claim for unpaid wages, you can bring a claim under one of those statutes. You can sue for your wages, you can sue for whatever penalties might accrue to you by virtue of what happened during your employment. But you can't sue for a final paycheck violation. You can only sue for a final paycheck violation if you didn't get paid something at the end of your employment, so vacation payout, sick time payout, something along those lines, or if the paycheck was just late. That part of the law stays the same as it is now. What it changes is the situation that I just described with wages that accrue during employment. So that's item number one from the statute, from the bill. Item number two is maybe even more technical and obtuse than item number one, so bear with me a little bit. 10-odd years ago or so, the legislature amended the penalty statute, 652.150, to add what we refer to as a pre-litigation notice requirement. And the idea is that the employee or the employee's attorney has to send a demand letter to the employer when he or she says he hasn't gotten all wages, and then the employer has 12 days to respond. If the employee doesn't send that written notice, then there's a limitation on how much the employee can recover in penalties. Instead of the 30-day penalty, they're limited to whatever the amount of the unpaid wages was. So to use our example, our employee who says he or she didn't get $10 in pay, if they sent the written notice and the employer just didn't respond, didn't pay up, employer would be on the hook for the $2,340. But if the employer gets the letter and says, oh no, you're right, we didn't pay you that, here it is, the benefit they get is they still have to pay the $10 in wages, but the penalty the employee is limited to is 10 bucks. It's the same amount of the penalty. And that's a benefit to the employer to try to correct these mistakes when they're brought to their attention. So that's the rule that the legislature conceived of when it added this notice requirement. The problem is there's an exception. It's two exceptions, actually, and the exceptions swallow the rule. Exception number one says that the pre-litigation notice requirement doesn't apply if an employer has violated the final paycheck statute more than once in the previous year. It's a good idea. We don't want to reward repeat violators with this beneficial penalty calculation. The problem is, how do you prove that you didn't violate the statute in the previous year? You're proving a negative. And what we often receive are, if we say, well, we didn't violate it in the previous year, we only owe you the 100% of your wages, the response I get back is, hey, that's great. Give me all your payroll records and all your time records and all your personnel files for every single employee, and let me go ahead and verify that you didn't violate it in the previous year. And if you can show that, then sure, we'll limit it to double damages. But other than that, you're going to have to pay the 30 days' wages. Now, that's totally impractical. The time and the money and the energy that would be involved in pulling together those sorts of records, analyzing them, and then serving up to the employee or opposing counsel, it just doesn't make any sense. So at that point, we end up just telling clients, pay the 30 days and move on. Exception number two was intended, I think, to refer to a mass layoff situation. It says that the employer isn't entitled to notice and the benefits of that notice if it laid off more than one person terminated more than one person on the same day. And I think the idea was, okay, employers, if you're laying a bunch of people off at once, then you got to spend the time and the energy to get things right and make sure everyone's paid. That makes sense. The problem is, the way the statute's drafted, it doesn't define what it means to terminate more than one employee on the same day. So imagine a big company that has a store in Portland and another in Klamath Falls. And they're managed totally separately. And two employees are terminated on the same day. One quit, one is fired. That have nothing to do with one another whatsoever. That employer technically terminated more than one person on the same day and isn't entitled to the pre-litigation notice. So this bill fixes those situations, fixes each of them. And the first one, instead of having to prove a negative and prove that we didn't violate it in the previous year, it says that proof of the violation requires either an order or a judgment, something that we can look up as a third party. Anybody with access to public records can look up, okay, was employer X dinged in the last year in an order or a judgment and found to have violated the final paycheck statute? If so, they don't get the benefit of the notice. If not, they do. Item two, it says that the terminations on the same day have to be part of a layoff. So it has to be part of a common scheme and not just this random event. So item three in this bill is an interesting one to me because I think, you know, there's an aspect to it that's both pro-employee and pro-employer. So I talked a little bit about the 30-day penalty in the final paycheck statute. That's actually how we calculate penalties for overtime and minimum wage claims under Oregon law as well. Now, so what that means is if employee A has $10 of unpaid overtime, they're entitled to a 30-day penalty. If employee B has $10,000 of unpaid overtime, they're entitled to a 30-day penalty. Even though employee B suffered 1,000 times the harm, they're entitled to the same penalty as employee B. Flip it around to from the employer's perspective. Employer A caused $10 worth of harm, but it's punished with a penalty of $2,400 for a $10 employee. $10 times 8 hours a day times 30 days. Employer B, on the other hand, caused $10,000 of harm, and it's punished exactly the same. That doesn't seem right to me, and that doesn't seem fair. What this bill proposes is that Oregon adopt the approach that's taken under the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, which is the federal minimum wage overtime statute. And it would instead of this 30-day penalty, it would award double damages. So employee A, who has $10 of unpaid wages, would get a $10 penalty. Employee B, who has $10,000 of unpaid wages, would get a $10,000 penalty. That's how this is non-scientific. Most states do it roughly that way. Washington does, I believe. And I honestly don't know why Oregon adopted the 30-day penalty approach. If I could just make one last point.
Of course.
I get it. Their wages, they're important. They need to be paid. We need to make the consequences serious to employers that don't pay wages. But the bad actors are going to act badly almost no matter what penalties we impose. And when we create this penalty scheme where the penalties are totally out of proportion to the amount of the harm, we end up sweeping in the employers that actually do try to get things right and make mistakes. And trust me, they make mistakes all the time because this stuff is really, really complicated. It's like doing your taxes. You know, lots of good people make mistakes on their taxes. That doesn't make them tax cheats. Lots of good companies make mistakes on wages. That doesn't make them wage thieves. And I would encourage all of you, I know you all meet with constituents all the time, to talk to your folks who, particularly in small businesses, who do payroll and do HR, and ask them, what's that like? What are some of the challenges you face? Because I bet you'll get some deep sighs and some eye rolls about how hard it is to get this right and to make sure people get paid. And that's who this bill is directed to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. So did anybody have any questions? No. Okay. Great. All right.
Thank you all so much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
No problem. So let's go ahead and hear from David Schunk and Matt Stevenson, please. Oh, Swanson. Sorry. Matt Swanson.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Chair Taylor and committee members. My name is David Schuck. I'm one of the owners of a small firm in Vancouver, Washington. We prosecute wage and hour violations in Oregon. That probably consists of 90%+ of my business. And I've been doing that for about, I'm a 99 bar member. So however long that is, that's how long I've been doing it. This is a problem. My firm has four attorneys, and that's mostly what everybody does. There is one person who does other types of employment law for employees, but the three out of the four attorneys, pretty much 100% is on wage and hour. Our clients are generally of the lower income. They start at minimum wage and below minimum wage, obviously, which is one of the claims that we bring. And usually they kind of top out right around $15 an hour, and that's about as high as they go. Once you go a little bit higher than that, we just simply don't see those claims that often, for whatever reason. The things that we see are varied. We see managers manually changing time clock entries so that the employee gets less. They look good because the main office sees that they're restaurant or their store used less hours of labor because they were changed, and the employee doesn't get their wages. Often the employees don't know that until right at the very end of their employment, and they figure that out, and then they complain, and then they're out of job, and then that's when they come to me. Sometimes they use electronic time clocks that can automatically change time, and it does so according to programs. Sometimes they deduct things that are unlawful. I could come up with 1,000 different ways that employers have taken wages from employees. That's what we see every day. The problem is that when you take a few minutes here or a few minutes there, it doesn't add up to a lot. And so how do you get people to come in, hire an attorney, or go to Boley and go through the process, which can take a year, to get what they took from them? And if they don't, who gets rewarded? The employer gets rewarded for having taken those wages. That's what you're dealing with. If you look at the history of these statutes, I put in a written document that was submitted to this committee, and it goes through some of the case law that has been in the Oregon Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, and it talks about, you know, how important this is and what type of disparity of power that the employee has versus the employer. And I won't go through all of that, but it's important to note that I think it was the Supreme Court that said that the penalty is to spur the employer to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it does that. And it's not like these have been here in secret. As Mr. Dudry just testified, you know, these have been part of Oregon law. The first citation that you'll see is from 1933, where they're talking, I think, 1919, where they added minimum wage. That's when, this is over 100-year history that these types of laws have been in effect to protect Oregon workers. So, okay. It isn't like the employer is surprised. Oh, my, I never heard of a minimum wage law. Oh, my, I've never heard of overtime. But yet, I still see cases where somebody has worked 50 hours and they pay them straight time for their entire week.
Okay.
If you look at this law closely, what you will see is it is not designed to protect good employers. It is specifically designed for bad employers, repeat offenders. Start with the provision of you have to have a judgment.
So, sir, do you want to wrap up your testimony? Just because we have other people signed up to testify and we're running out of time. So I just want to, if you could go ahead and you want to summarize, and we'll have Mr. Swanson speak. I understand you're here against the bill, and I'm hearing that your testimony that you're against the bill.
What I would say, look at the provision that protects the employer from the full penalty. Mm-hmm. Start there. To get a judgment in a case takes a year. Most cases never get brought, and of the cases that get brought, 90%+ of them settle. So there's never a judgment. So there's never a bad actor if there's never a judgment. What we do in cases is we prove that they violated the law repeatedly, and then we don't have to have the minimal thing. And then you go from there. Every single statute says you can't mix and match. Well, what if they violate every single statute? How do you get there? What's the harm? If the employer violates all the statutes, then they can only get tagged for one. So why not? Just violate them all, get as much money as you can. It's designed to help the bad actor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming. Hello, Mr. Swanson, how are you doing?
Quite well.
Yeah, so you've been
quite
patient well. Waiting to the end here. So
very, very
or almost
patient.
The end. We have some other people signed up after you.
Yes, I'll do my best to be brief.
Oh, no,
and I appreciate
yeah.
your attention in this busy time in the building. Once again, Matt Swanson with the Service Employees International Union, Oregon State Council. On behalf of our members, we're urging your opposition to Senate Bill 999. We do so because we think this would very much limit the ability of working Oregonians to receive justice when they have been wronged by an employer. And contrary to what I think proponents may have argued, we believe that our wage and hour statutes actually are not robust enough in the protections for workers or easy enough for workers to access the type of justice they need. So I think, and this bill is definitely dense, so I think I'll try to highlight a couple of the objections we really do have. First of all, we think that this appears to be a pretty confusing attempt to limit employer exposure to employment law related claims that an employee or worker may bring when they've been wronged, particularly claims that involve multiple sections of the employment law statutes. So for kind of the offender who checks multiple boxes, this appears to give them a get out of jail free card for many of those offenses. And we think that's just a wrong approach to the enforcement of wage and hour law, and it deprives workers of some of the justice that they would need. So for instance, a worker who has not paid overtime, has an unlawful deduction, and did not receive a paycheck in a timely manner could lose needed remedies for some of those violations in our reading of this law. It's the idea that you can't have simultaneous and concurrent. I don't have the bill in front of me. I believe that was the language that appears again and again in their proposed changes to the statute. That's something that would be very problematic for us, because that basically says, you know, the worse offender you are, the more ways you get out of being accountable to the law. That's a problem. We also believe that in terms of this law seems to roll back some of the penalties around wage violations in a way that would not help workers at a time, frankly, when most workers are struggling to get by. It is a very stressful problem for a worker who's been deprived of wages or something that they're counting on, right? I think workers do try to track their hours and know what they're owed, and this bill really appears to make that harder for them to recover wages when needed. So I think in our mind, this is a concept that not really a conversation we're interested in entertaining. We think that Oregonians need more protections, not less. And the idea that some of the worst offenders, like my colleague here we're talking about, could essentially get out of jail free is problematic for us. So with that in mind, we urge your no vote. Definitely happy to take any questions, but this is a dense bill, so if it gets too deep, I may punt to my colleague here who's past the bar.
Okay. Any questions? Also, just for the record, we are only having a public hearing. There is no work session.
Certainly.
And there's no work session scheduled, so for yes. the record. So you said, just wanted to clarify that. Okay. Well, thank you both for coming up.
Thank you.
And so we'll bring up Arthur Towers, Michael Dale, and then Sybil, did you want to come up with them or come up on your? Okay. That'd be great.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Mr. Shuck did a very good job representing us today. The only thing I would add, and you've heard this a lot, but I'll say it again because it bears repeating, is that the folks that we're talking about here in terms of missing out on their wages are predominantly low-wage earners. And so $10, you know, $100, $250, whatever it might be, makes a big difference at those wage levels. And when it's even more than that, obviously it's much more painful. And so I just want to emphasize that the deterrent qualities that exist in current law need to be preserved, and in my opinion, enhanced. But this bill obviously does not do that. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Mr. Dale, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, it being a late hour and this being a very dense and confusing bill, I'm just not even going to try to do justice to it. Our message, as you know, I represent the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft. We believe that the laws are too weak. This moves in the wrong direction. It removes protections that workers now have, protections that are inadequate. According to an analysis by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, just looking at people who filed a claim at BOLI. Now, understand, this is the tip of the iceberg because most claims don't get filed. Some claims get filed in court. The few people who live close enough to a BOLI office to be able to make a claim at BOLI, we're just looking at that. So we're looking at a small subset. But just that subset, $45 million in wage claims have been filed with the state of Oregon over the last 10 years. And it's not getting better. In our observation, it's getting worse. We need better protections, not less protections. This bill, in multiple ways, creates less protections. It upsets. There were talks about the notice and the notice that had to. I was involved in the negotiation of that. That was a very carefully crafted and balanced agreement among parties to allow the provision to go in. To upset one side of that is not the right thing to do. And I think I'll just leave it at that. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you for coming, Mr. Dale. I know you're well-versed in these topics in this area. So, okay, and Sybil.
Thank you so much, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. I'll be very brief. We have significant concerns about this proposal. I have detailed testimony about our concerns with each of the sections that's entered into the record. And I guess the only thing that I would just add is that, as you all know, our clients are low-income people. The majority of our clients are working, and they are living very much paycheck to paycheck. And so, you know, the idea that the actual wage value of a violation may not be a large number, that's not the way to assess the impact or the negative impact that that has on an employee. Because if your payment doesn't come through in the amount that you're expecting, you may not be able to make rent that month. You may not be able to, you know, keep your food budget so that your kids are eating the way you want them to that month. And so these violations, if you're working and you're not paid fairly as you were promised to be paid and as is required by the law, they're serious issues, and we appreciate the way the statute is structured now to provide disincentives and to make sure that people are careful and don't violate. So we wanted to just put our concerns on the record, and thank you very much for the time.
Okay, nice summary there. Any questions from anybody? Okay, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 999. And then our next meeting is going to be on Monday, April 17, and we are going to be having work sessions, and some of these, as we've already discussed, are going to be going to Ways and Means, and some of the bills that are on the agenda are Senate Bill 299, and I know that Senator Hansel, you're working hard on that one, that has to do with sick leave. There's Senate Bill 329, and there's Senate Bill 559 and 560, which we've already discussed, and then the three bills that we carried over from today, which are Senate Bill 828, 984, and 1040. So I'm going to adjourn the meeting on Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you. Thank you.